Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am your host for today, Shatranjay Mall. Today I'm speaking with Professor Yin Chow about his new book, From Policemen to Revolutionaries, A Sikh Diaspora in Global Shanghai, 1885 to 1945, which was published by Brill in 2017. Professor Chow is an associate professor of history at Tsinghua University in Beijing. So thank you for joining the podcast today, Professor Chow.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Shatranjay.
Thank you for joining us. Our first question is always biographical, so I'd like to ask you about your background. Where did you grow up? How did you become a historian? How did you become interested in modern India-China connections?
Great question. Actually, I was born in China. I was born in eastern China, a city not very far from Shanghai. And my bachelor actually is not in history. I study economics and management during my undergraduate studies. And then I came to Shanghai and I study international relations. So when I study international relations, I came across some issues about the foreigners and the foreign settlements in modern Shanghai. They had, you know, Jews, Russians, Japanese, and Americans, and of course Indians, right? So then I want to write something about the Jews in Shanghai originally. So my first thinking is about to write the Jewish settlement in modern Shanghai. Then I moved to Singapore to try to, you know, pursue my PhD degree in National University of Singapore. I just give this proposal to my supervisor, right? And my supervisor said, no, you cannot do that. A lot of people already done this, right? You should change the topic. I have no mind, you know, I don't know anything else. I asked my supervisor, what can I do? What else can I do, sir? So you should I ask you to give me a new topic if I cannot write something about the Jews in Shanghai? And he told me, okay, you should write something about Indians in Shanghai. Indians in Shanghai, actually before that, I have no knowledge of Indians in Shanghai. Then as a young man, actually, I have some confidence in myself, right? So I said, okay, if you give me this topic, then I can do it anyway. So that's why I begin to pursue this PhD degree under this topic, and then that's why this book comes into this book, Sikhs in Shanghai.
Thank you for sharing that. I mean, I think it's great that you were able to uncover this history, because many people are not familiar with this history of Sikhs and Indians being in Shanghai. And it's your book is a very fascinating account of this forgotten history. So could you tell us some of the major arguments and contributions of your book?
Great. Because when I come to write this book, right, the Indians in Shanghai, then I try to, bring or borrow some knowledges of other books, other studies, which are about Japanese in Shanghai or Russians in modern Shanghai. Because anyway, Shanghai was a cosmopolitan city in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And I find that all of these books about the Jews, the Russians or Japanese, their settlements in Shanghai, and it's only about the city and the migrants in the city. It seems like they don't have any connections with other parts of the world. Then, at the beginning of this research, I also want to do such a... I intend to write in this way, right? And then I find a lot of primary sources of the Sikh, of the Indians in Shanghai. I find most of the Indians are Sikh, the Sikhs from the Punjab in northwestern India. And they were policemen, right? They were policemen in Shanghai. They were recruited by the Shanghai Municipal Council to police the local Chinese. Then I find that if I want to write a history of the Sikhs in Shanghai, I cannot ignore their connections with Hong Kong, Singapore, California, Canada, and India, of course, right? So it shouldn't be a local history. It should be a transnational, translocal history. That's why the book became, in the end, the book becomes not a foreign settlement in Shanghai, but a foreign settlement in global Shanghai, foreign settlement in a global network that's a network centered in Shanghai, right? So the main argument of this book, I think, it's about the foreign policemen to revolutionaries. It's about the transformation of identity, but it's more about how can we write a local history with a global approach, right? So my argument is that if you want to know the history of the Sikh community in Shanghai, you should put them in a global transnational network or transnational networks to understand this history. So that's an argument.
Thank you. Yes, when I was reading your book, I was sort of very struck by your use of the term translocal and sort of trying to not just place, as you were mentioning, like not just place the Sikhs in Shanghai within the local context of Shanghai and China at that time, but putting this in this global context, as you said. So I found that to be really fascinating. So before delving further into the book, I had a question about the research process. So what sorts of archives and sources did you use for writing the book? And where did you do your research?
Great. First of all, I did my research in Singapore because I pursued my PhD in Singapore. And because I was in Singapore, then National University of Singapore, their main libraries and the National Archives of Singapore, actually they provide excellent service to my research because they have very good archives and all colonial archives and the foreign office archives of the British Empire, right? But the problem is that my research is about Shanghai, and in Singapore I can only find archives about street settlements and mm-hmm. Singapore in particular, right? So the interesting thing is that, of course, I went to Shanghai later and I find a lot of archives in local archives and the newspapers in Shanghai's archives and the libraries. But because I did my research in Singapore and I spent most of my years in Singapore, then I think, okay, I cannot waste my time and my opportunity of staying in Singapore and just doing a Shanghai study, right? That's why I try to make use of the archives in Singapore. I mean, this all about the Singapore and the street settlements archives, and try to connect or make a connection between street settlements, colonial archives with Shanghai Municipal Archives. That's why if you read my book, you find, wow, how can you connect the Shanghai history with Singapore history? And of course, Hong Kong, because I also spent 1 year in Hong Kong and try to explore and investigate the colonial office archives in Hong Kong. And then by connecting Singapore, Hong Kong, and Shanghai, I find a network. This network is not about a Chinese diasporic network. It's about Sikh diasporic network by using the three place archives. And then I try to explore a broader context. That's why I went to India. I went to United States, right? I also used the archives in India, especially in Calcutta, the Netaji archives, and in California's Sikh community archives, try to bring the Sikh diasporic network in a real global context. So that's basically the archives I used. And unfortunately, I want to say is that I didn't find any, Sikh manuscript or Sikh text. I mean, because this book is about Sikh communities and Sikh migrants, and a perfect research should include the indigenous people's voice, their own writings, right? Of course, I learned Punjabi, but the problem is that because of the limitation of my research, and especially the PhD candidateship lasted only for 5 years in Singapore, that you have to graduate by the end of the fifth year of your candidateship. That I don't have enough time to explore more indigenous archives and indigenous texts. I didn't find anything that written by the Sikhs, indeed, by the Sikhs themselves in Shanghai or in Singapore and Hong Kong. That's a very regrettable thing, I think, in my book. I should point it out. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing all of that. It seems that you did a really, you visited so many different places and you really looked at many different archives. When writing a book, it's impossible to include everything that one could possibly include. So it's understandable how you were not able to include some of these Punjabi language or maybe Sikh perspectives. But hopefully there can be other scholars in the future who build on your work and are able to sort of include those sources as well if they are able to find them. So as I'm sure our audience must be wondering, and you mentioned about this, about how there was like a Sikh diaspora in Singapore, Hong Kong, and in Shanghai. So how did these port cities in East and Southeast Asia become home to an Indian and specifically Sikh diaspora community?
That's an interesting story because it's a very accidental but interesting history. Because when the British, they came to Asia, they came to colonize street settlements, Hong Kong, and then build a settlement in Shanghai, right? They have a big problem. They have big challenge from local Chinese. They didn't have any knowledge of how to police this local Chinese. But you know that in the 19th century, a lot of Chinese, they came to Singapore. They stayed in Hong Kong, and they have a lot of secret societies and a lot of social problems. But the British, they didn't find appropriate policemen to discipline this problematic elements, right? Because if they recruit a lot of British policemen, the cost is too high, right? Because the salaries was too high. And if they employ the local policemen, the Chinese policemen, the problem is that they developed a suspicion that the local Chinese policeman was highly corrupted, and they're gonna collaborate with the Chinese criminals, and even have some even big problems for the British colonial authorities. So that's why they tried to do some experiment to introduce a third element to police the local population, right? And then in Hong Kong, it's 1860s. In Hong Kong, there was an experiment to try to see how about employing some Sikh policemen in Punjab and bring them to Hong Kong and to police the local Chinese. And this experiment got very successful. And then the Singapore police authorities, they saw the success in Hong Kong, right? So they imitate the Hong Kong's model and also employ some Sikhs to Singapore to police the local population. And finally, is Shanghai in 1885, as I mentioned in my book, that Shanghai got the experience from Hong Kong and Singapore because the Shanghai Municipal Council, they saw this Sikh policemen very helpful in oppressing the local riots. And also they thought that the Sikh policeman was a military man. And when the Chinese authority and the Chinese government, if they want to invade or they want to intervene in Shanghai's local issues, the British, they can organize these Sikh policemen and make them as soldiers and to defend Shanghai's international settlement. That's the beginning of the Shanghai's Sikh police force.
Thank you. That's a really fascinating history, and it's really fascinating how the British sort of used Indians or like used people from the Indian subcontinent and brought them to discipline like Chinese communities across East and Southeast Asia, and how they were sort of using one community against another, one Asian community against another. So that's really, really interesting. I actually, as you were speaking, I was remembering the movie Crazy Rich Asians, in which there's a scene in which there's a security guard who's sort of wearing a turban and so on.
It's very Orientalism indeed. It's very Oriental because, you know what, in a lot of these kind of the movies, right? I mean, especially movies that try to describe the modern Shanghai, right? There must be some Sikh policemen sit behind the scene, and I mentioned it in my book, right? They stand there, they didn't say anything. They just stand there with their turbans, with their beards, right? And it becomes like a colonial context. In this movie, that without the Sikhs, it doesn't look like Shanghai. If you want to show people it's Shanghai, it's modern Shanghai, it's Shanghai's international settlement, it's a cosmopolitan Shanghai, you must include a Sikh policeman sit behind, right? But it becomes an Oriental discourse and an Orientalist imagination. Where are the subjectivities of the Sikhs, right? Nobody cares about their subjectivities. Nobody cares why they came here, their everyday life, what they are pursuing in Shanghai or Singapore. It becomes like a decoration of something very colonial, right? That's why I'm trying to restore the subjectivities of these Sikh migrants in East Asia in my book.
Exactly. I mean, it almost seems as if the Sikhs or like people wearing turbans are sort of just adding to the exoticized view of like Shanghai or Singapore or any of these cities. And as you were saying, like they're just like mute spectators and we don't hear their perspective. So it's great that your book has sort of reminded us of their subjectivity and of their history in all of these places, and specifically in Shanghai within this global context. So in chapter two, I think in the introduction in chapter one, you talk about the origins of the Sikh community in Shanghai. So in chapter two, you provide a global micro history of Sikh migration through the case study of one Sikh migrant named Isair Singh. So could you tell us a little bit about him and about the broader story you're trying to convey through Isair Singh's life?
That's very interesting because, you know, I'm a great fan of microhistory. I'm a great fan of global microhistory. You know, there's a trend nowadays that try to ask our students to write a global microhistory instead of global history and try to challenge the very mega narrative and elite perspective of global history, right? So we try to write everyday life of ordinary people in global history. And when I was doing my PhD thesis, right, I always reminded myself that Cao Ying, you must write something of global micro history. And I read quite a lot of books, especially that book inspired me a lot, written by a British historian, Robert Beakers. I think he's now teaching in Bristol University. He's a great historian of modern China. And he wrote a lot of books of modern Shanghai. And actually he had a book written about an ordinary British policeman and his life in Shanghai in early 20th century Shanghai. And this guy is a working class British. And he came to Shanghai, right? And he died in Shanghai, right? He had a lot of affairs in Shanghai. But this guy is really an ordinary people. He's not a merchant. He's not the politicians or any powerful people, right? He's just an ordinary people, powerless, struggling in his life. You know, he got drunk and he got a lot of family problems, and he exiled himself to Shanghai, tried to find a better life here, but then died, being killed in Shanghai by the Japanese. So I was fascinated by this story. I think, okay, if Robert Biggers can write a story of the ordinary British people in Shanghai, why cannot write an ordinary Sikh people in Shanghai? Then I came to search the information. But the problem is that it's more difficult than writing a micro history of a British, because if you are writing a micro history of a British, you, of course, you can go to Britain, go to UK, and find some private correspondence and private diaries or letters, and you can reorganize the life of these people, right? But the problem for the Sikhs is that we didn't find anything written by themselves, right? Just as I mentioned, at least I didn't find. And they didn't have private correspondence or letters, right? So then I searched the newspaper, local newspaper. I searched all new local newspaper about the Sikhs in Shanghai from late 19th century to 1940s. And I find a man whose name is Isa Singh, right? The main character of this chapter. And interestingly, I find quite a lot of newspaper articles. I mean, not quite a lot, but at least 20 newspaper articles mentioned this man. And I had to check whether it's different people with the same name or one people, right? Then finally, I find the conclusion is that it's the same people. There's only one Isa Singh. It's this man, right? And because of these newspapers, of course, by using these newspaper articles, by using this information, it's still inadequate to write the micro history, because it's still very limited information, right? So I find, okay, I can use these people to try to reflect or shed some light on the broader context of the Sikh everyday life in Shanghai. Where they stay in India, why they choose to come to Shanghai, right? How they were brought to Shanghai, when they arrived in Shanghai, what was the infrastructure to support their everyday life in Shanghai, right? And what happened to them later, right? So that's why I tried to write this micro history and try to use the case of Isa Singh to bring more attention to the subjectivity or everyday life of ordinary people, or as I say, subalterns, the foreign subalterns in the cosmopolitan Shanghai.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. As you mentioned, that one of your efforts was to sort of, you know, move beyond these stereotyped or these like orientalized portrayals of like Sikhs in Shanghai. So by doing this global micro history and by sort of doing what's been done for British or other like European or Europeans in cities like Shanghai, and sort of using that method to sort of recover this figure, like that's really, really interesting that you were able to do that. And it was quite fascinating to read about as well. So as Sikhs began to migrate to North America in larger numbers in the early 20th century, Shanghai developed into a conduit for migration flows between Punjab and North America, so like United States and Canada. And this was also a time of rising anti-colonialism and anti-imperialism, as exemplified by the Ghadar Party. So could you tell us a little bit about this, about the activities of the Ghadar Party in Shanghai and just the increased level of politicization of Shanghai's Sikh diaspora in the 1910s and 1920s?
Great. Because this point is the turning point of this whole book, from policemen to revolutions. Why? Policemen, they were defender of the British Empire, and the British Empire trusted them, right? They saw that the Sikhs, they were loyal soldiers, they were loyal subjects, right? That's why we brought them to Shanghai, brought them to Hong Kong, to defend our empire. We trusted them. But what happened? And the defenders of the British Empire becomes a rebellion of the British Empire. became, they tried to overthrow the whole British Empire, not only in India, but also in China and in Southeast Asia. What happened to this Sikh policeman? So that's a turning point, this book. And by using the case of the Garda movement in Shanghai from 1914, the First World War, right, all the way to 1930s or 1940s, I try to say that, look, these men were not suddenly become crazy and revolutionaries, right? There was a process behind it, right? And this process is what is about the Sikh migration from Shanghai all the way to North America, to Vancouver and California. Why? Because of the money, because of the economic reasons. Right? They came to Shanghai because they can earn much higher salaries in Shanghai than in Singapore, Hong Kong, or in Punjab, right? Mm-hmm. And they came to Vancouver or California because they find even more prospective, more promising economic opportunities in Vancouver, right? That's why they tried to organize themselves and tried to, even they had a shipping company, right? And tried to transport their people all the way to North America. But then they came across a problem. The big problem is anti-Asian sentiment in Canada and in North America in general. Of course, if we are studying the migration history, we know that the anti-Chinese sentiment was growing in the early 20th century in North America, right? And what we didn't know is this anti-Chinese sentiment also influenced the Indian migration to North America. And this Indian migration to North America and their struggling in this migration inspired the Indian nationalist sentiment, especially the Sikh nationalist sentiment. Right. So when they came to the coast of North America and when they found that the Canadian authorities didn't allow them to land on the shores of Vancouver, they got very angry. It's not only them who got angry. Also, their countrymen back in Southeast Asia, back in Shanghai, also got very angry. We were so loyal to the British Empire, but Canada at that time was still part of the British Empire, right? But when we try to move freely within the empire, from one part of the empire to the other part of the empire, we were rejected, we were discriminated, right? So we were not, as the British authorities claimed, that equal to all subjects of the empire. We were inferior to the white man, anyway. And the root problem, the root cause of this discrimination is that our home country, India, was colonized by the British. Then they came to organize themselves into a revolutionary party, the Garda Party, right? And which based in California. And then First World War happened. First World War broke out and all of these Garda Party members went back to Asia, went back to India, and because they find that it's a golden opportunity for them to overthrow the British authorities. And how? How? Because North America is so far away from India, they must find a transition point. And this transition point is Shanghai. Why Shanghai? Why not Hong Kong, Singapore, or other parts of Asia? Why Shanghai? Because Shanghai is very special. Shanghai at that time had a big problem of sovereignty. Because in Shanghai, there were two concessions or settlements, foreign settlements, and Chinatown. The Chinatown was governed by the Chinese authorities. But the two concessions, one is French concession, the other one is international settlement. The international settlement was largely governed by the Shanghai Municipal Council, which was managed by British merchants, British businessmen, right? So the sovereignty, although the two concessions, politically speaking, is still part of China, but they were not governed by China. And they were not also, they were not governed by British authorities either. So it's just a settlement. That's why when the Sikh revolutionaries, they migrate back to Asia, they find Shanghai is the best place for them to hide their identity, to hide the hunting of the British intelligence office. That's why Shanghai becomes a hub, revolutionary hub for all the Sikh Gurdwara Party members, right?
That's really intriguing to hear about Shanghai's special position, and because of its unique sort of patchwork of sovereignty, with some areas being governed by the British and others being connected with the Chinese, that because of that, like, it was sort of more suitable as a place for, you know, Indian revolutionaries compared to Hong Kong and Singapore, because I guess because Hong Kong and Singapore were fully under British control, so maybe it would have been harder to sustain a revolutionary movement compared to Shanghai. So yeah, that's really fascinating to hear. Actually, one of the figures that I'm interested in, Raj Bihari Bose, he too, I think, was interested, and he tried to go to Shanghai at some point during this time, and he was sort of connected with the Gadar movement as well. But I think his effort was not successful. One of the figures you mentioned here, I think his name was Buddha Singh. Could you tell us a little bit about him and about his role in all of these, in the Sikh history of Shanghai?
Oh, he was the most influential and the most powerful Sikh man in Shanghai. I mean, as far as I know, even in the history, in the 50 years history of the Sikh community in Shanghai, he was the most powerful man, right? And he was a leader. He was a leader not only of the Sikh police force in Shanghai's police force, but he was also the leader of the Sikh community and the Sikh society in Shanghai. Mm-hmm. He organized quite a lot of Sikh religious activities and events in Shanghai. That's why the British think this man is very important and promote him very quickly, because the British find this man, he had the capability, he had the talent, I would say, to organize by using religion to organize his countrymen in Shanghai around the British. And he keep teaching his people to be loyal to the British rule in Shanghai. And he kept telling the Sikhs in Shanghai that by only be loyal to the British in Shanghai, we Sikh people in Shanghai could get our opportunity. Right, that's why the British in Shanghai and the Buddha Singh, they find a collaboration. I would say that they find a perfect collaboration that can mutually help each other. Right, that's why the Gurdwara Party members, they thought Buddha Singh was the most dangerous man in Shanghai for their revolutionary movement, because Buddha Singh, he was extremely loyal to the British. But on the other hand, he hunted down quite a lot of important Gurdwara revolutionaries in Shanghai. And he even had his own spies in Shanghai's Gurdwara, the Sikh temple. Right, he had his own spies, and these spies, they attended all kind of revolutionary activities that happened in the Gurdwara, and they even had a list. Whoever came to Shanghai, joined the Gurdwara Party movement, his name will be forwarded to Buddha Singh, and Buddha Singh will forward this list to the Shanghai Municipal Police, and the police will just arrest this man. So that's why the revolutionaries find this man very dangerous. And finally, they find a chance in 1927, right? They find a chance to assassinate him, right? And kill him. But the problem is, in my book, I point out that Buddha Singh's assassination actually reflect that not the failure of the British intelligence work in Shanghai. The British, actually, they have a very sophisticated intelligence gathering network, not only in Shanghai, but across the world, from California all the way to India. And they had already informed Buddha Singh that someone would assassinate you, someone from Gardar Party would assassinate you, and you should bring your bodyguard every day along with you. But that day, right, that day Buddha Singh happened to forget something at home, and he didn't ask his bodyguard to walk along with him. He walked along, and this gives this chance for the assassins to kill him. So it's a very fascinating story. And another thing is that actually Buddha Singh's great granddaughter was still alive, and they contacted me. And they asked me to rewrite the story of Buddha Singh. They insisted that Buddha Singh was not loyal to the British. And they insisted that Buddha Singh's assassination was because of the jealousy. Of course, I know that there was a lot of jealousy and factions within the Sikh community in Shanghai, right? So I'm very happy to know their story. I mean, from Buddha Singh's family and his descendants. I think they have some diaries or documents, family documents, right? So maybe in the future, I can write a new story of Buddha Singh. Maybe can tell you more.
That's really fascinating. Thank you. I mean, I think as you were speaking, I was just thinking about another thing that we should keep in mind about the Sikh community, that it wasn't just a monolith with everyone having the same view, but there were like different political opinions, and some people might have been more loyal to the British while others were sort of more revolutionary and more anti-colonial. And as you mentioned, like there had been this shift in many of them, which led to the emergence of the Gadar Party. And it's also really fascinating that you were able to get in contact with his family and get their perspective about the assassination of their ancestor. So the Sikhs of Shanghai were also involved with the Indian National Army, that is the military force in East and Southeast Asia organized through Indian diaspora networks, and captured prisoners of war, which would, with Japanese support, fight the British and allied powers during World War II. So could you tell us a little bit about Shanghai's position within the Indian National Army at the time of the Pacific War, and what role the Sikhs of Shanghai played in the Indian National Army, the INA?
Great. Actually, this story is very interesting because it's the fourth chapter of my book. It's the last chapter of the book. And when I write this chapter, I have an idea. Because in Chinese mindset, during the Second World War, Shanghai was a lonely island. In Chinese, we call it a lonely island because before the Second World War, Shanghai was, of course, a cosmopolitan city. Everyone comes to Shanghai because it's a playground of adventurers from across the world. And then during the Second World War, in the conventional nationalist historical narrative, Shanghai was totally isolated from the outside world, right? So it becomes a lonely island. Then I find, but from the perspective of the Sikhs, from the perspective of the Indian National Army, Shanghai was by no means a lonely island. Shanghai was actually a transporting hub for the Indian National Army and for the Sikh community across Asia. Of course, under the sponsorship of the Japanese instead of the British, right? And in 1942, in the beginning of the Pacific War, Shanghai Sikh community was actually marginalized because at that time, you know Rash Behari Bose, right? Rash Behari Bose stayed in Japan for long years since he exiled from India in 1920s. And the problem is that Rash Behari Bose and another Indian National Army General Mohan Singh, they paid their attention to Southeast Asia. They didn't have any connection with Shanghai. So although Shanghai had a very strong existence of the Sikh population, but Indian National Army in 1942, they forgot Shanghai's Sikh community. So in this way, Shanghai's Sikh community being marginalized in the early stage of the Indian National Movement and Indian National Army movement, right? But it was not until Netaji came to Asia, right? Another boss. Netaji boss came to Asia and he reorganized the Indian National Army, had its headquarters in Singapore, and then they moved the headquarters to Burma. And when Netaji Bose tried to mobilize all Indian population in East and Southeast Asia, he came to pay attention to the Sikhs in Shanghai. You know why? Because he developed a friendship with Wang Jingwei. Wang Jingwei was a puppet regime of nationalist China, because at that time all occupied China was governed by a puppet regime under Wang Jingwei, right, the president of the puppet regime. And Wang Jingwei met Rattachi Bose in Tokyo in 1943, and they became very close friends. And Wang Jingwei invited Rattachi Bose to China. And Bose came to China in 1942. And then Bose came to realize that, wow, there was a large Sikh community in China, very large, even larger than Singapore, larger in Malaysia, larger in Japan, of course. And all of them are Sikhs. And they had military training because they were martial race, and most of them were employed as policemen, right? At least they were better than civilians, right? So this time, Subhas Chandra Bose, he came to realize that I must make good use of this Sikh population in Shanghai, right? So that's why he ordered to build a lot of training camps in Shanghai to try to train all Sikhs and try to transform them into soldiers and then bring them to Burma to join his campaigns of reoccupying India, right? But unfortunately, none of these Sikhs trained in Shanghai's training camp being transported to Burma because of the lack of transportation in the later years of the Second World War. So that's why Shanghai becomes a transport, becomes another hub of the Indian National Army movement.
Thank you. That's again a really fascinating history, and it just sort of underlines how important your book is, because it sort of recovers this forgotten history of the Sikhs of Shanghai and the role that they played in the Indian National Movement in East and Southeast Asia. So amidst the chaos and confusion in East and Southeast Asia after the end of World War II, all Sikhs ended up leaving Shanghai. But as we discussed earlier, their history in the city has been marginalized, although they remain present in literary and cinematic images, memories, and other representations of the city in the early 20th century. So could you tell us a little bit, as we come to the end of the interview, about the significance of the story of Shanghai Sikhs in trying to tell a history that's freed from imperial and nation-centric biases?
Great, because I write this story not as a Shanghai historian. Interestingly, because just yesterday I got an invitation and asking me to go to Shanghai to attend a conference of modern Shanghai history. And I said, I'm very sorry, but I didn't think that I'm qualified enough to be recognized as a Shanghai history historian, right? Because I'm really not a specialist in Shanghai's history. I try to write this history as a global history, as you can find it, right? And this is my, I think, one of the most important contribution of this book is not putting Shanghai as a modern Chinese city and try to study China's modern, right? I write this story, try to put Shanghai in a transnational network. This transnational network is not only about Western and Eastern, right? It's not about British and China. It's about India. It's about global India, about Indians in Hong Kong, in Singapore, in Shanghai, in California, in India, right? I think this is the main contribution. I think it should be the main contribution of this book, that by reading this book, you find that, okay, we study Chinese history, modern Chinese history, we should jump out of this nationalist discourse. And we also need to jump out of British-centered British Empire history, right? And we can write a history from below by telling the stories of the ordinary Isa Singh, Buddha Singh, these ordinary people, and by telling their intentions, their strugglings, their ambitions, right? We can actually not only tell a global history, we can tell a global history from below. We can just restore the subjectivities as supporters who can not only stay in their hometowns, waiting for the Westerns, waiting for the modernity to bring them to other parts of the world. They can move by their own willingness. So that's the main intention, I think, in my book, try to tell our readers.
Absolutely. I can definitely see that as a major contribution of your book, not just seeing Shanghai as sort of a gateway to China, but rather seeing Shanghai also within these broader networks, not just in East and Southeast Asia, but also in networks that connected back to India or connected beyond to North America or other parts of the world, for example. And also the other point you said about like writing histories of the British Empire without putting the British at the, you know, in the central role, like I can definitely see that that's also a major contribution in your book. And I hope more scholars sort of take that same approach in sort of writing histories of the British Empire without like, you know, making British colonial officials like the central point of their research. So thank you for sharing all of that. And thank you for taking so much time from your busy schedule to talk with me today, Professor Chow. So before we end, could you tell us what you are working on right now and what's next for you?
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you for your time too. And actually, my new book will be published soon. I mean, maybe next month or just soon. And it's a new book about Chinese sojourners in wartime India, right? It's about the Second World War and how Chinese sojourners came to India. Because this book, the current book, is a continuation of the book we discussed today. Because just as we mentioned, right, Subhas Chandra Bose came to Shanghai. We mentioned this episode. And so when Subhas Chandra Bose came to Shanghai and he made a broadcast to Chinese nationalist government, and he complained a lot. He said, when I was in India, because Subhas Chandra Bose used to be the president of Indian National Congress, right, before he came to be imprisoned by the British. And he said, when I was a president of the Indian National Congress, we sent a lot of help and assistance, medical help to China to help you, right? And now you send a lot of soldiers, sojourners, troublemakers to India to help the British defend their imperialism. So, I mean, wow, what happened to these people, to these Chinese sojourners, to India during the Second World War? That's why I came to write the second book, and this book will come out soon, right? So, but now I'm working on a third book, actually. And the third book is about the India-China infrastructural connections. I mean, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, there were a lot of infrastructural connections the British imagined to build to connect India and China by bypassing the Malacca Straits. So this new book is about how the British policymakers, investors and merchants imagine how to find a way through Himalayas, through Myanmar, to build railways, to build roads, to build, you know, canals, to connect India with China by bypassing the Straits of Malacca. So that's what I'm now doing.
Thank you. Both of those sound like really fascinating projects, and I'm very keen to read the book that's going to come out very soon. So thank you for telling us about that. I hope our listeners, they read both your books. They read this book on the history of Sikhs in Shanghai, and also this other book about the upcoming book about Chinese sojourners in India. And it's really interesting because now I'm also, as you were speaking, I remembered that Chiang Kai-shek, he traveled to India during World War II together with his wife and met Gandhi. So it's interesting that there was like two different perspectives that see about about the connections between China and India during World War II. So I look forward to studying and reading about that soon. So this was an interview with Professor Yin Chao about his book, From Policemen to Revolutionaries, A Sikh Diaspora in Global Shanghai, 1885 to 1945, which was published by Brill in 2017. So thank you for speaking to me today, Professor Chao.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time.